This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., where the temperature feels like boiling and the partisan rhetoric really is disturbing. On today's show, what does religion have to say about taxation? We think of the federal budget as a moral document. We'll talk to Peter Larman of Progressive Christians Uniting about the current debate over the Bush tax cuts taking place right now in Congress. Also, the religious right often argues against gay marriage by making the claim that it would undermine the sanctity of marriage. We'll talk to a man in California who is a bit skeptical of that argument. He is orchestrating a tongue-in-cheek attempt to ban divorce in his state in order to protect the sanctity of marriage and to expose the hypocrisy of the religious right. But during the last few weeks, we've seen how race can be a powerful and divisive force in American politics. Shirley Sherrod, an official at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, gave a speech to the NAACP in which she confessed she didn't give a white farmer the full force of what I could do, in her words, after he asked for assistance. That remark ignited the conservative blogosphere, and Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack demanded Sherrod's resignation, despite the fact that later in her speech, Sherrod stated that she had learned from her mistake and told the audience to aspire to greater racial harmony. President Obama has since called Sherrod and apologized, and Secretary Vilsack has offered her another position at the USDA. In spite of the resolution of this situation, though, I think this incident calls for another assessment of the role of race in America. And I can think of absolutely no better person to discuss this topic with then my next guest, and with my great friend, Dr. Jim Forbes, who's the former senior minister of Riverside Church in New York City. Dr. Forbes now heads the Healing of the Nations Foundation, and Jim Forbes joins me by phone. Jim, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's good to be back with you, Welton.
In the interviews, they talk about throwing somebody a softball. I'm going to throw you a softball. What in the world is going on with these increased racial incidents?
Welton, you remember the days when people would go in for cancer surgery and wait for the pathology report. And the question was always, did they get it all?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have been through periods where we have fought against racial thinking, racial behavior, and the civil rights era sort of got some of it out. We've passed through another phase where we joyfully decided we're going to even have a black president. Mm-hmm. That took away a lot of the stigma of America as a racist society. But the question is, did they get it all?
Mm.
And the truth is, we are discovering that rather than getting it all, like opening up a situation, mm-hmm. the image of a black president and also economic downturn and continued struggle with terrorism and the problem in the Gulf of Mexico. All of this actually has stirred up what's been there all the while. Mm-hmm. And for each of the incidents, whether it is the Shirley Sherrod statement or whether it is the rather abusive language used in criticizing President Obama's response to immigration, each incident is only an expression of the fundamental conflict, and that is, no matter how hard we've worked at it, we are still a society where race plays an inordinate influence in the way we live and respond to one another.
Are you satisfied, maybe is the word, with the way President Obama is living up to his ideals as elaborated in that speech that he gave during the campaign about race? I know lately I've seen some columnists saying that the Obama White House has kind of bent over backwards and is kind of permitting some racism that it shouldn't allow. What's your feeling about that?
Well, you know, I've always said that whenever you go to a diving competition, you should know that the score should be based not only on the individual performance, but the degree of difficulty of the dive. Given what the president has been facing, I think he gets pretty good scores. Mm-hmm. However, he has made some splash, and I have two options. Either to pile on, saying, you know, you didn't do everything you said you were going to do in the campaign, or else I can do what presidents have always required. Try to maximize my energy in creating the condition under which he is forced, mandated, or given the pragmatic energy to move in the direction I think he ought to go. So there are enough people from the Tea Party all around to pile on. Mm-hmm. My thinking is I want to do all I can to make it impossible for him not to be aware that you can bend over backwards all you want to, but at the end of the day, as deep as racism is, you can never do enough.
I'm almost embarrassed to ask you this question with so little time left, but I've got to. As head of the foundation, the Healing of the Nations Foundation, you're bound to have a thought on what should be the next step for our country, for our people, in dealing with where we are right now racially.
Well, of course, you know I'm going to get in a commercial. In my book, you know, Whose Gospel, mm-hmm. I address the issues of race and class and sex and war and the environment and gender. Mm-hmm. My thinking is that all of the problems you and I have been talking about, at the root of it, there is a spiritual malaise. And I want to spend as much of my energy promoting spiritual renewal, because I am convinced that once people are properly grounded in a faith that is relying upon equality of justice as mandated by the prophetic tradition of most of our faith, that we will have less need to find scapegoats or to quake and tremble every time the issue of redistribution of power and resources comes up.
You know, Jim, I'm glad you mentioned your book. You know, I think it's a great book. And I actually was thinking the other day, as thumbing through those pages with those topics that you just listed for us, and I thought, you know, it's almost like after Jim wrote this book, our society tried to give an illustration for every one of these chapters.
Exactly. It's almost as if you've heard that the sublime satisfaction is experiencing the question being raised for which you have attempted to give an answer.
Dr. Jim Forbes is the former pastor of Riverside Church in New York City, always articulate. He now heads the Healing of the Nations Foundation. He's a very significant spiritual presence in our midst. And, Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
I enjoy it always, Welton.
I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. And up next, Congress is busy debating what to do about the Bush tax cuts. Now that they're about to expire, our next guest views this debate not just in policy terms, but in biblical terms. Stay tuned here on State of Belief. You'll either like it, not like it, but we'll have something to talk about. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. As you know, our show operates at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. And at first, you might not think that federal tax policy fits that particular intersection. Well, think again. Fundamentally, a system of taxation is a reflection of moral and even religious values. What is a fair contribution for a person to make to support the community? What sorts of priorities should government set with the money they take in? Congress is currently asking themselves these kinds of questions. They're debating what to do with the Bush tax cuts passed in 2001, which are set to expire soon. A recent poll conducted by Pew and the National Journal found only 30% of Americans believe the tax cuts should remain in place. On the other hand, 31% of Americans support repealing all of the tax cuts, while 27% support repealing tax cuts for the wealthy. Now, our next guest, who is no stranger to State of Belief, is going to help us cut through the minutiae of tax policy to focus on the bigger issues involved in this debate. I'm joined on the phone with Peter Larman, Executive Director of Progressive Christians United, an organization, in their words, inspiring and equipping individuals and communities for courageous leadership in the 21st century. Peter's a minister, a longtime activist for social change, and a friend of mine. Peter Larman, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's great to be here, Welton.
You recently wrote a piece in the online magazine Religion Dispatches entitled, Why Taxing the Rich is the Godly Thing. Give us a short answer to that question.
Welton, it has to do with domination and power and the threat to democracy when wealth is untaxed and relatively unaccountable and able to opt out, really, of the democratic conversation. I was reminded the other day that the originator of the idea of progressive taxation was none other than Republican President Theodore Roosevelt, who said, and I'm quoting him, the really big fortune, the swollen fortune, by the mere fact of its size, acquires qualities which differentiate it in kind as well as in degree from what is possessed by men of relatively small means.
Mm-hmm.
I think Teddy Roosevelt had a great insight there. What we've done is we've lionized and we've valorized wealth, and now we're even saying that rather than tax the extremely wealthy people in a fair way, we should simply leave it up to them to decide to invest in productive job-creating industry when the record shows that they don't do that. They use it on luxuries.
It seems to me, Peter, that the Republicans, and I don't think it's as a result of strategy, but they've got the Democrats in a place where they have a legitimate, looks-like-winning argument either way, that if you leave the tax cuts in place, you increase the national debt incredibly high, or if you take the tax cuts away, then you're going to be charged with increasing taxes. It seems to me that the Obama administration needs to find a way to recast the debate. Would you have suggestions on how they do that?
I think the president needs to get up on that bully pulpit here and say, what's the record in terms of really wealthy people who've enjoyed these tax cuts actually creating useful investment, job-creating investment in this country. And the difference between leaving it to them and using progressive taxation, which is a big part of our national history, as the power to create, the power to create public goods that are desperately needed now.
You quote in your article Chief Justice John Marshall, who almost 200 years ago famously wrote that the power to tax involves the power to destroy. That's contradictory to the kind of argument you're suggesting that the administration use. Why is it so hard for progressives to recast this debate in a positive frame?
I don't know. I think we're out of practice about this. I mean, I quoted Teddy Roosevelt earlier. Teddy Roosevelt, arose in the context of a broader surging progressive movement where people were talking about and they did it in terms of the future of democracy and the health of democracy. They said, we cannot permit this gap. And you had at that time, you had people who were corporate titans, many of them, Andrew Carnegie, most notably, Carnegie, I think is how he preferred to pronounce it, saying that having all of this wealth and being unaccountable to the public was a social wrong. I mean, he cast it in, in almost biblical terms. As I say, I think we've foolishly lionized wealth and kind of decided that, we should just leave our entire national fate to the wealthy. But as you and I have been discussing, it's dangerous for democracy, obviously, and it's grotesquely unbiblical.
Well, let's stay with that terminology a minute. You and I have been among those people who, particularly during the Bush administration, talked about viewing the budget, the federal budget, as a moral document. How do you rank President Obama's budgets from that perspective? Does it really reflect society's basic values?
We're down to just 20% of the federal budget that is non-mandated discretionary spending. So there's a pretty small margin in there, and I think within that 20% margin, this presidency is doing very well. But if he loses this one, maybe we think about all the things that are troubling that are kind of carryovers from the Bush administration, the national security state. Some question about torture over at Bagram, constitutional questions. Those things are all worrisome. But if he loses this one on the power to tax for good, right, for the good of the whole, then I think it's a rapid slide downhill from there.
Peter Lehrman is the executive director of Progressive Christians Uniting. Peter, it's always great talking with you and reading what you write. It's always good commentary. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief.
It's always my pleasure and privilege, Welton.
Later in the show, we welcome back our Intersection Awards. But up next on State of Belief, we're going to be talking to an activist in California who is trying to make a point about the hypocrisy of the religious right. John Murcott is trying to put a question on the state ballot to abolish divorce. You want to hear this one, friends. I guarantee you we're coming right back after this short break. This is State of Belief, brought to you by the Interfaith Alliance. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back, everybody. This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. As you well know, a favorite argument of the religious right on the issue of same-gender marriage is that it would undermine the sanctity of marriage. Well, take a listen to this advertisement posted on YouTube supporting a ballot initiative currently gathering support in California.
Right now, traditional marriage is under attack. An epidemic is sweeping our nation, and you have the power to help.
Every divorce starts with the death of a traditional marriage.
Right now,
that's right.
Anyone who legally gets married.
The California Marriage Protection Act hopes to preserve the sanctity of marriage by abolishing divorce. Now, this tongue-in-cheek proposition is in the process of gathering enough signatures to put it on the 2012 ballot in the Golden State. Now, I bet you're asking the same thing I did when I heard this. Who has a sense of humor large enough to orchestrate an effort like this? Well, the answer to that question would be John Mercotte, the proprietor of the website rescuemarriage.org. John Mercotte joins us now by phone from California. John, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, thank you for having me.
I suppose I should first ask you whether or not you're married.
Oh, yeah, I'm married, have been for 7 years, and I have two beautiful girls.
Great. What may I ask you, what does your wife think of what you're doing here?
Well, you know, when I first kind of came up with the idea, I had to pay $200 out of pocket to file the paperwork necessary for this ballot initiative. And there wasn't much of a guarantee we were going to see that money again. But she was supportive, and you know, things have turned out, I think, better than we could have hoped for in terms of people giving us support and kind of latching onto this idea. And she has been with me every step of the way.
Oh, that's great. Have you been active in politics before?
Not outside of the voting booth.
Uh-huh.
I've never been active in a political campaign. I've never been an activist of any sort, really. This is a first.
What punched your button? I mean, what about this attracted you to the cause?
Well, I was inspired by Prop 8, the proposition that banned same-sex marriage here in California.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of annoyed by it because when I first looked at it, I saw it as a pure civil rights issue that, you know, should gay people have the right to get married? I said yes. But then when it passed, I went and looked at the Yes on 8 website because I was curious what their motivation was. And what struck me was they didn't even mention the word gay, homosexual, or lesbian on the front page of their website at all. All they wanted to do was protect traditional marriage and protect the children. And I thought those were great and noble goals, but they went about it in such a strange way.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to protect marriage because it's sacred, don't stop gay people from getting divorced or from getting married. Stop straight people from getting divorced. So I took the ideals, I think, of Prop 8, and I'm taking them to their logical conclusion.
I'm curious, what has been the reaction of people in your community, the religious community, the secular community? How have they seen your petition efforts?
It's been very interesting. I get support and detractors from all across the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I get support from people on the religious right who believe in covenant marriage and who believe absolutely that you should not be able to get divorced. And then I get, I've had a tremendous outpouring of support from the gay and lesbian community on the left. And at the same time, I will get people on the right who, you know, feel I'm making fun of them or their arguments and are very dismissive and angry with me. And I'll get people on the left who have called me the Christian Taliban and, you know, said that I'm trying to enforce my religious viewpoint on them via the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
So the types of responses I've gotten have been all across the board, all across the political spectrum. And it is interesting. I've really found that this is a, like you said, beyond the idea that some people have that this is a joke, this is really something that makes people think. And and they want to get into it, and they want to argue one position or the other.
What kind of reaction have you received from the gay and lesbian community?
You know, that's been the most surprising part, I suppose. I've gotten a tremendous amount of positive reaction from the gay and lesbian community. I can't even say I have, you know, close friends who are gay or relatives or anything else. These type of issues up until this have always been very abstract for me. But I've made a tremendous number of new friends that are gay and lesbian. I've had gone to meetings where people find out who I am, and they're very excited to meet me. And, you know, I'm a minor celebrity in that community, which is really odd because I really didn't have much of a connection with it before now. But I've been they've been nothing but nice to me, and I appreciate that.
How is the petition gathering actually going?
Well, we just got cleared to gather signatures a few weeks ago, and I put together electronic versions of the petitions that people in California can download, and a set of instructions that tell you what the legal requirements to gather signatures are. So we've really just distributed them a few weeks ago, and we've gotten a few back, but I really don't think we'll have a good idea of where we're at probably for another few weeks when we start seeing kind of the returns coming back into our P.O. box to find out how well the signature gathering's going.
How many do you have to have? How many do you have to have? How many signatures?
You have to have a million. You have to have a million signatures in order to get the 700,000 valid signatures. What I've been told is in order to get 700,000 valid signatures, you actually need 1 million, which is why, you know, getting some sort of external funding is so important. I mean, the ballot initiative process was designed to empower people, to start grassroots movements like this. But what it's turned into is that unless you have millions of dollars to pay people to stand in front of Walmart and gather signatures, you can't get something on the ballot. It's turned into a way that special interests can get bypassed the legislature and get things passed. It very, very infrequently is really a true grassroots movement.
Sure.
It's all about special interest groups, and I'm trying to shake that up a little bit.
Have you got to raise the money, or have you got people that will help you raise the money?
We're not, you know, we've funded ourselves by selling T-shirts and accepting donations.
I see.
You know, it's a, I'm not a professional political operative. I don't have a lot of fundraising experience. And if I was given a tremendous amount of money, I would want to make sure that I had some legitimate plan to, to spend it wisely. So I'm happy with the amount of money that we're getting. We could always use a little bit more, but if someone gave me millions of dollars to do this, well, I don't want to discourage it. Never mind. Yes, they should give me millions of dollars to do that. What I have been disappointed in is that the big funders of Prop 8, which were the Catholic Church and the Church of Latter-day Saints, have not been receptive and have not contacted me or offered me any funding. I'm Catholic, and in the Catholic faith, we don't even have divorce. It doesn't exist. And so I would feel that what I'm doing here is much more in alignment with traditional Catholic teaching than even Prop 8 was. And yet I can't seem to get the church on board gathering money in and evangelizing from the pulpit the way they did against our for Prop 8.
I'm curious, what happens if, and I mean this is a huge if, the Supreme Court rules in favor of equal rights for gay people? How would that affect your campaign?
That would be interesting. It's a, you know, we're right now at the federal appeals level. We're at the federal court level. And then there's an appeals court above that. And then I think it goes to the Supreme Court. There's several ways to go. You know, we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it. It is definitely going to go to the Supreme Court. I don't think anyone doubts that. At every level, the whatever the decision is going to be, the other side will appeal, and this will go all the way up to the Supreme Court, and I suspect the Supreme Court will hear it, but that's years into the future, and by the time it actually gets all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, my window of opportunity to either gather signatures or get this on the ballot will have passed. So it'll be a done deal by then.
John Marcotte is the proprietor of the website, and you may want to write this down, rescuemarriage.org. Rescuemarriage.org. Go there. You can find out more about the California Marriage Protection Act. Evidently, you can make a contribution. You can buy a T-shirt. John, it has not only been fun talking with you, it's been insightful talking with you, and I hope to goodness that your activism as an individual pays off so that not only you help achieve equality for gays and lesbians, but you show that an individual can make a difference in this political process. Thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you.
There's still more to come on State of Belief. When we come back, we'll get a traffic report from the intersection of religion and politics. We're bringing back our Intersection Award segment with State of Belief veteran William Blake. Stay tuned, please. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy, and it's time once again for the Intersection Awards. Man, I'm glad we have these back. We hand out green lights, yellow lights, red lights, depending on how successfully people navigate the intersection of religion, politics, and government. Every week, the Interfaith Alliance monitors dozens of news stories involving religious freedom, and this is a way we can call your attention to a few important issues that we've discovered. Now, longtime listeners to this show might remember this voice. In fact, I'm sure they remember this voice. William Blake is the former press secretary of the Interfaith Alliance. He's brought us Intersection Awards off and on for the last 4 years. He's now pursuing his Ph.D. in government at the University of Texas in Austin. William joins us now by phone. William, what do you have for us today, and welcome back.
Thanks, Welton. I've got three stories, and, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and so we have three red lights that we want to hand out tonight.
Okay.
We first head out to Tennessee to hand out a red light to Republican gubernatorial candidate Ron Ramsey. Now, Welton, you talked about this issue on the show last week, but I don't think Ron Ramsey was listening too closely. At an event in Chattanooga earlier this month, or last month, Ramsey said, "You could even argue that being a Muslim is actually a religion, or is it a nationality, way of life, cult, or whatever you want to call it." Now, Ramsey's campaign later released a statement saying that Islam has, quote, come to resemble a violent political philosophy. Now, well, if we wanted a stereotype like this, we could easily say the same thing about Christianity after Eric Rudolph murdered people at abortion clinics, right?
Yeah, but we can't say that, and it shows that Ramsey guy is, I don't know what office he's running for, but what he sounds like he's running for is divider of the year. He is talking in general terms about a religion he obviously knows nothing about, and he is firing up attitudes that can, in sick minds, become violent, and he's doing nobody any favor unless he thinks it's helping him gain a few votes, but they're not votes for the kind of America and the kind of American leadership that we need.
Well, and as you know, Welton, from the Interfaith Alliance's activities in Tennessee, there is, it may be in the Bible Belt, but there is a lot of religious diversity, and Ramsey is clearly not paying attention to it.
Right.
Well, next we head down to South Carolina to hand out a red light to pro-life activist Randall Terry, who recently hanged and beat up effigies of Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican representing South Carolina. What warranted this harsh treatment? Kerry was protesting Graham's promise to vote to confirm Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. Now, as a political science graduate student, I can tell you that protesting a Supreme Court nominee is a relatively recent phenomenon. Up until recently, Supreme Court nominations attracted little attention or controversy. In fact, Justice John Paul Stevens, who Kagan would replace, he was confirmed in less than 3 weeks after he was nominated by a unanimous Senate. But things have changed in recent years, haven't they, Welton?
They've changed a lot. And, you know, what I see playing out in that kind of action from Randall Terry is the dangerous philosophy that the religious right often embraces of the end justifies the means. It is a utilitarian ethic in which even people are treated in a utilitarian manner. And Lindsey Graham likely has done a lot of votes and offered a lot of rhetoric that supported causes that Terry had an interest in and probably agreed with. But you disagree on one vote or disagree on one action and you're written off. That is not the way we can do democracy in a nation with the kind of diversity that we have, and it deserves a red light. It's disturbing.
Yeah. Well, I think our we've saved our biggest red light for the end, and we want to hand that out to the Livingston Parish School Board in your home state, Louisiana, Welton. The school board recently decided it's going to explore the possibility of teaching creationism in the public school system science classes. The board cited a new law passed by the Louisiana legislature that allows schools to present evidence of, quote, critical thinking and creationism in science classes. Now, Welton, this is not the first time Louisiana has tried to do something like this, and on a prior occasion, the U.S. Supreme Court had to intervene to stop Louisiana school boards from teaching creationism. So my question to you is, why are they still trying?
Well, William, my response to that is not one I'm very proud of. My guess is they've never stopped trying, and many teachers have never stopped teaching it anyway, that students are getting a full dose of it. For some reason, it seems more religious to some people to denounce science as a way of protecting faith rather than to embrace the best of science as the best opportunity to find a contemporary expression of faith that can be helpful to people. I have said over and over in my ministry as well as on this radio show, thinking is not a sin. And if people would understand that and know that getting a good education is a religious responsibility, they'd quit toying with people's minds and trying to be indoctrinators and become supporters of an education system that offered children the kind of instruction they need to live in our kind of world.
Well, I think you should print up T-shirts with that phrase, thinking is not a sin. I think they would sell.
Yeah, we just have to be sure the spelling's right.
Yeah.
William Blake is a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin. William, man, it's good to have you back and hear your voice. It's always good for you to be on here. Thanks for doing State of Belief today.
My pleasure.
Well, those, my friends, are the final words for this week's show. Although we have to wrap up things for today, I remind you, you can visit us anytime during the week at stateofbelief.com, and we wish you would. If you like what you've heard today, tell other people about us. Help us get the word out about State of Belief, and tell people to visit us online, sign up for our podcast, that's at stateofbelief.com. And as always, I remind you that State of Belief is a production of Interfaith Alliance. If you want to get more involved in the cause of religious liberty, join us, please. We need your help. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We'll be right back here on State of Belief next week. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.